Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Already threadbare prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, America's social safety net can no longer hide its deficiencies. From insufficient funding of our healthcare system to failures in providing access to healthcare and or insurance to citizens, to a serious lack of help for rank-and-file employees who don't have enough sick leave or who have none at all, and often no income protection during economic downturns, all of this has been glaringly revealed by this crisis. Congress spotted some of these weaknesses and passed legislation to provide temporary relief, but now many of those protections are expiring, including additional unemployment benefits and reprieves from evictions and utility disconnections. True, the coronavirus has created a perfect storm of a healthcare and economic crisis, but other nations don't seem to have been as critically impacted. So, with America's deficiencies exposed, is there political will to fix them? We look into that on this Politics Monday with Victor Chen, Associate Professor of Sociology and Social Policy at Virginia Commonwealth University and author of Cut Loose, Jobless and Hopeless in an Unfair Economy, and The Missing Class, Portraits of the Near Poor in America. He joins us from Richmond, Virginia. Welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, Mike.
And with us in Washington, D.C. this morning, Michelle Evermore, Senior Policy Analyst for Social Insurance with the National Employment Law Project. College Park, Maryland. Welcome to you.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. And in D.C., Jen Schutz is a fellow at the Metropolitan Policy Program's Future of the Middle Class Initiative at the Brookings Institution. Thank you for being here, too.
Good to be here, Mike.
Victor Chen, let me begin with you. All of the cracks that have emerged, all the problems that I just mentioned, have been with us for an exceedingly long time. Is it just that, taken one by one, we didn't notice them, we didn't feel the impact of these deficiencies, that it took this perfect storm to bring them to our attention? Or is it that Americans are simply hardwired to steer clear of broad social safety nets for whatever reason?
Yeah, we've had this long history of a really frayed social safety net, but we should have known, Mike, in the Great Recession, we just had an experience of prolonged unemployment and where we needed to intervene to help lots of jobless Americans, and yet we took the opposite tack in terms of actually reducing the strength of our safety net in the years that followed that Great Recession, at least in some states. And you could see that in places like Florida now, where benefits, the length of benefits were cut dramatically. The system to deal with the unemployment claims was really not built up over those years. And there was a concerted effort by lots of lawmakers to push people off of benefits and make them more tied on work and other sorts of requirements. And so if anything, we've gone in the opposite direction in recent years, with some notable exceptions, such as the Affordable Care Act, right? But I think in general, we just have a more self-reliant kind of attitude in America in regards to a social safety net, which doesn't do well in these times of major crisis when you need to support the great mass of working Americans who are now find themselves out of work and needing of some sort of assistance.
Most of our recent discussions as a society have revolved around health care as a right as opposed to a privilege. It's what finally led, I think, to the Affordable Care Act being passed, though efforts to gut that act continue even now. But this crisis has also shined a light, Michelle, on worker protections that have been weakened over the years as the influence of unions has diminished over time. Again, were workers oblivious to the deficiencies that they have to deal with in their work lives and in how work supports their private life, or simply powerless to do anything about these deficiencies?
You know, I think it's definitely a combination of both. If you look at a state like North Carolina, you know, it's one of the states that after the last recession gutted unemployment benefits the most. Duration of unemployment benefits is only 12 weeks. the amount has been reduced by changing how they're calculated. And, you know, a lot of that has to do with labor unions. You know, people who belong to a union are far more likely, they're twice as likely, as a matter of fact, to apply for and receive benefits. And, you know, it's sort of a circular situation where when somebody's in a union, they understand their rights. When they understand their rights, they form unions. It's that cyclical effect, I guess.
In North Carolina, I want to stay with you for just a second, Michelle, because in North Carolina, I understand the reason we have among the worst unemployment benefits is that when Republicans gained control of the legislature and for a while when Pat McCrory was governor, they were trying to get the unemployment system under control. They owed a lot of money to the federal government. For what reason, I'm not sure, maybe the economic downturn, and they wanted to cut benefits so that they could get that under control. I understand they have done that. So why haven't they increased the benefits? Do you know?
That's a really good question. Going into the recession, actually right before the recession, I wrote a paper about North Carolina being overfunded, and now's the time to increase benefits if you actually want to be recession ready. There are two really important things to have in place before a recession happens. One is a good trust fund, but secondly, if the trust fund isn't paying benefits to anyone, it's of no use. So the benefits in North Carolina are wholly insufficient, and the 12 weeks of duration is totally insufficient as well. Thank goodness Congress passed the CARES Act to paper over those insufficiencies, but as those programs expire, North Carolina is going to see a lot of pain.
Jan, both you and Dr. Chen focus a lot on the middle class. Would it be accurate to say that America has a middle class largely because of the efforts of union protections and policies that came as a result of union protections in other parts of the country, along with government social programs like Social Security and Medicare?
That's a really good point. A lot of the policies and sort of social safety net that the U.S. have are gamed more at the middle class than at poor families. So housing markets are a good way to think about this. A lot of federal housing policy is aimed at home ownership. It's aimed at helping people buy a home, tax incentives to help them keep them in the home. We have a lot more protections for homeowners through federal regulation of mortgage markets. We've tended not to provide similar kinds of supports for renters who tend to be poor households. And that's one of the things that we've really noticed in the current recession, that the federal government actually doesn't have that many tools to protect renters from eviction. And we don't provide a lot of financial support to renters. So even before the crisis hit, 10 million households were spending more than half of their monthly income on rent. And you can imagine what those households are going to do when they lose their job or have their hours cut due to the recession.
Well, Social Security came along because of Franklin Roosevelt and his response to the Great Depression because of the New Deal. And maybe it's because it's been in place for so long and it's become the third rail of American politics. You can't touch Social Security that we just take it for granted. But since it was so successful in doing what it was supposed to do, and since Medicare has been relatively successful for a lot of people, why the reluctance to not strengthen those programs, increase those programs so that we look more like what's going on in other parts of the world? We see these things working. Why aren't we willing to expand them? I'm not sure which one of you to ask that question of.
Well, I think it's Jen. The culture, Mike. We just have a sense in our country of individualism, of self-reliance, of meritocracy, and all those are good, traits and characteristics and values that we have as Americans. But it leads to a certain type of approach that we only give substantial aid, it seems, during moments of crisis. And even then, we do it in such a short period of time, as we saw in the Great Recession, or patience for these social policies is not very long. And we also just focus so much on work-based kind of social programs, right? So much of our assistance, whether it's child tax credits or the earned income tax credit, you know, all these sorts of things are based on whether you are working. And that is not so good when a pandemic leads to widespread joblessness, right? And so I think that is part of our cultural approach to our safety net that is so full of holes during a crisis that is this long lasting and leads to such widespread precarity.
And Michelle, he brings up an interesting point. We seem to want to tie everything to work, food stamps, et cetera. If you don't work, you're not getting fed. And there's something to be said for that, because we want people to be self-sustaining and self-supporting. You don't give them fish, you teach them how to fish, is the old saying. But when we talk about some of the benefits that have come from unionization in Europe and the protections those workers have over there, we point to them as almost being disincentives to work. They have outlandishly long vacation time and other benefits that American workers don't have. Is there something to be said for that, or are we wrong?
The Chicago Fed actually did a study and found that people who are unemployed are the people who are the ones looking hardest for work. The people who are on unemployment insurance who are unemployed are the ones looking hardest for work. I think that there, you know, this idea of tying things to employment, I mean, I work for the National Employment Law Project, right? We understand the value and the importance of work, dignity of work. On the other hand, we also understand that work can be very discriminatory. The kinds of jobs that you can get are limited by your gender, age, and race. And tying every single piece of assistance solely to work doesn't make sense either.
Morgan Housel, who's a partner with a venture capital firm called Collaborative Fund and the author of a book called The Psychology of Money, told CNBC that this country has not historically faced any kind of destruction deep enough to prompt a widespread shift in how we view the world and how we think about our social safety net. We were spared the devastation of World War II, which led Europeans to demand a more predictable future achieved through a dependable social safety net. So, Dr. Chen, will this be, this pandemic that we find ourselves in now, be that moment in American culture that we experience that kind of a shift in thinking?
It can be. I think we really have a pivot point in our history right now where we can go in various different directions. And moments of crisis create these sorts of opportunities, as you know, we saw during the Great Depression and we saw during the Great Recession in a very different way. You could see mobilization with labor unions and other groups around these causes, and that leads to enduring change. And during the Great Recession, we had the rise of the Tea Party, right? That kind of reaction, a backlash against the benefits being given to underwater homeowners and so on. In the Great Depression, we had a mobilization for the safety net. So we can go in either direction, but it really depends on what's happening on the ground in terms of the social movements that are kind of coalescing around certain policies, in terms of the leadership that we have at top, at the state level and federal level. I think that it's an open question whether we're going to build a strong safety net along the lines of European model. But I would say that there is greater interest in things like a universal basic income now that is gaining some traction, you know, among world leaders, among the Pope and so on, right? I mean, there are some new kinds of innovative ideas that are being talked about across, countries and including the United States. And so I think there's that possibility to move forward from the kind of very frayed social safety net and bare social safety net that we've had in the past.
We're going to go through this as we go through the rest of the hour here. Dr. Victor Chen is with us from Virginia Commonwealth University, Michelle Evermore from the National Employment Law Project, and Jenny Schutz from the Brookings Institution. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the societal, the social safety net and whether it will change in any way as a result of this COVID-19 crisis. Dr. Victor Chen is with us, Associate Professor of Sociology and Social Policy at Virginia Commonwealth University and the author of Cut Loose, Jobless and Hopeless in an Unfair Economy. Michelle Evermore, Senior Policy Analyst at the National Employment Law Project, and Jenny Schutz, a fellow at the Metropolitan Policy Program on the Future of the Middle Class Initiative at the Brookings Institution. They were talking about, Dr. Chen was talking just prior to the break, Jen, about this idea of a of guaranteed I guess salary would be the better way to say it. It was one of the platform proposals, I believe, from Democratic candidate Andrew Yang, which a lot of people scoffed at, but that was pre-COVID. Maybe they wouldn't be scoffing at that right now, but during the campaign for the Democratic nomination, at least, Bernie Sanders, as he did in the last election, sparked a lot of imaginations among younger Americans with a cry for greater social protections and greater economic equality. Does that mean that at least a portion of American society is already on a track that might change things as they grow older and gain more power?
We're definitely seeing different attitudes towards a safety net and towards sort of how some of these programs work among younger households. And if you think about sort of how much we're shaped by when we come into the labor market and the experience we have, so Gen Xers like me were very lucky. Most of us came into the labor market at a time when it was pretty easy to get a job and to rise up in your career. It was still relatively affordable for people to buy a house and sort of build themselves into the middle class. A lot of the millennials came into the job market during the Great Recession. So they had a difficult time getting their first job, getting a job that paid enough that they could move out of their parents' house and establish independent households. So that's really shaped their worldview. It's understandable that for relatively young adults, they see the world as a place where economic shocks happen frequently. It happens regardless of how hard you work, what your skills are. You know, if you come into a labor market where people with good talent, good skills, good education, who are willing to work, can't get jobs and don't have jobs that provide benefits and some sort of security, they're going to be looking to government to provide some of the stability that, frankly, the labor market just doesn't provide.
Well, the Great Depression resulted, as we said, in Social Security because it shook the people's worldview. I mean, things were horrible in the 1930s as a result of the stock market meltdown of the 1920s and other things that were going on. Is this comparable to that? Is this an event that could, combined with the Great Recession, that could really change the way we look at our social safety net, the way we look at employment, et cetera, Michelle?
Absolutely. You know, I am hearing more and more talk about just federalizing unemployment insurance. You know, this is the last week that the $600 supplemental unemployment benefit is available. After this week, it's gone. And I'm terrified that Congress doesn't reauthorize it. And I'm worried about what happens when we fall off that cliff. I think this is a real moment for organizing around a true safety net, a meaningful safety net. And I think that once the $600 turns off, people are going to see how it affects them. Right now, there are a lot of people who are getting the benefit and understand the benefit and understand what it does for them. When it ends, the people who don't get the benefit will see what it was doing for them as the economic effect of unemployment spending really spreads into the community and people start to lose work.
If there's one thing that politicians understand, it is elections. So is it dangerous? Is it politically dangerous at this point not to recognize this for what it is and reauthorize it?
Absolutely. If there's anybody listening who is not collecting the $600 and think that it therefore doesn't affect them because they've been going to work and maybe they're even a little bit upset because people have been sitting home collecting a benefit, but they've been able to work. If they think that this benefit doesn't affect them in a month, I hope that they're right. Mm. but it's probably not true. It's probably the case that, you know, one of the big features of unemployment insurance is it's an automatic macroeconomic stabilizer, and it keeps money churning in the community. During the last recession, every dollar spent in unemployment insurance generated $1.61 in local economic activity. And that, from initial indicators, appears to be the case now.
I think it's true that people who benefit most from Social Security are the middle class, and probably the lower class as well, or the lower economic classes as well. But there is a substantial portion of the population here that views universal health care and worker protections as suspect. They see them as unneeded government interference in a free market economy. But they favor Social Security. Don't touch that. And they favor Medicare. Don't touch that. Why the disconnect, Jenny?
Well, people like benefits that they receive themselves, and they're suspicious of benefits that go to other people. And one thing that we haven't brought up yet is that there's a big racial disconnect in how well people are doing in the economy, what kinds of opportunities they have in the labor market, and what kinds of challenges they face. So one of the reasons why it's been easy to build broad support for Social Security is that was something that most people paid into during their working life and receive. So it's viewed as something that's shared. You pay into it and you get benefits. People enjoy this.
Yeah, and that's my money. You owe me that money. I put it in, right?
That's right. Okay. We're much more suspicious of things like food stamps or direct cash benefits to households, housing assistance, that go to a smaller portion of the population. And even for things like sort of broad-based tax policies, you know, the biggest housing subsidy that we have is the mortgage interest deduction that goes to homeowners. Most of the benefits go actually to very affluent households who have expensive homes and have big mortgages on those. People who own their homes and get the mortgage interest deduction don't think of that as a subsidy. It is, but they don't think the government is paying for them. On the other hand, don't you dare give money to a poor family so that they can pay the rent. That's a subsidy. We don't like that. The mortgage interest deduction is just something that I deserve for owning my own house.
Is that something that's baked in, or is that something we believe simply because we don't understand the intricacies of how all this works under the surface?
I think both. Government tax and subsidy policies are incredibly complicated. Things that go through the tax code, you don't recognize that you're getting, you don't necessarily know what the dollar value is that you receive or pay in. So it's a little bit opaque there. But there's also a lot of very deliberate rhetoric by politicians. The Republican Party for a long time has talked about people who are makers and people who are takers. So if you're getting cash benefits from the government, then you're a taker and somehow you're a leech on society, and people who work, people who own businesses are makers and they're benefiting. It's not that simple. Everybody gets benefits and everybody is dependent on one another. But we've had this rhetoric that encourages sort of an us and them mentality.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, Dr. Chen, because for more than 150 years, this country got along just fine, some would say, without Social Security, without any kind of Medicare, without any kind of social safety net. It was literally a pick yourself up by the bootstrap society. And if you failed, so be it. Off to the poorhouse you go, or worse. Why do we need these things now, I guess, is the question. If we got along without them before, why do we need them now? Is something fundamentally different about the American economy, the global economy, or the mental or physical health of Americans today that we suddenly need all these things?
Yeah, Mike, we live in a globalized economy nowadays, a interconnected and interdependent competitive global economy where there's a lot of technological advances that will mean a lot of us won't even have jobs perhaps in several decades into the future, right? So we have to have a more imaginative approach towards social policy moving forward that accounts for not just the massive job losses we're seeing, seen now during this pandemic, but the possibility that a lot of folks, you know, some estimates up to a third of the workforce won't have jobs because of automation. And then you have on top of that competition from other countries that have hit lower wage workers quite hard in the American context. So I think we need a new approach, a new cultural approach that recognizes, yes, that we're all in this together, right? We need to provide, you know, benefits right now so that the economy keeps going, that people keep spending, and lower wage workers are the folks who spend that money and keep things moving. So I think that idea that we need policies that are just go beyond this very individualistic and narrow viewpoint is really important for us to...
Well, we are a consumer economy. It seems everybody acknowledges that. Democrats, Republicans, conservatives, liberals, we are a consumer economy. Without the American consumer buying stuff, it all falls apart. If nobody's making any money, if there are no subsidies, how do we make the wheel turn? Anybody want to venture a guess as to how that happens? Or does it just all collapse? Michelle?
I would just point out that, you know, productivity has skyrocketed since the 70s and 80s, and wages have remained largely stagnant. Things are still getting made, but people aren't seeing their share of the profit, actually. And if we actually paid people the same as we had per unit created, there probably wouldn't be poverty in the United States, right? I think that as more and more things can be automated, less and less work actually has to be performed. And that's okay. We just have to figure out how to compensate people and how to make sure people can consume.
Right? I know you're a worker advocate here. So, but tell me where that money is. If that money is available to be paid out to the people making the widgets, if they had a bigger share of the profits and therefore they made more money, they'd be able to buy more stuff. One would think that would cause all boats to rise and we'd have a more affluent economy all around, a stronger middle class. Certainly. Where's that money going now? Is it just going to CEOs and stockholders? Is that where it's going?
Yeah, income disparity is at an all-time high. And, you know, lower paid workers are receiving less and less in terms of buying power every year. And CEOs, you're right, you know, executives, the wealthy just continue to accumulate.
Is it greed or is it a lack of understanding that this is actually hurting the economy?
I think it's greed, and combined with the fact that there's sort of a race going on among the top 10%, among the top 1%, to be the wealthiest possible wealthy. And, you know, at some point it just becomes this strange game. And, you know, CEOs are on boards of other companies, so there's sort of a pact to make sure that everyone gets paid well. That has an effect on what they have available to pay labor.
Yeah.
And that greed, Mike, really is continuing into this pandemic. Some of the provisions that were slipped into the CARES Act gave tax deductions to ultra wealthy individuals, millionaires and billionaires and corporations, right? That together amount to almost as much as we gave in terms of stimulus checks. There's this conversation about, oh, you're giving too much to unemployed workers. And yet we have all this money to shift over to the ultra wealthy in terms of these tax deductions on charitable deductions and past losses and so on that are making them considerably wealthy. So that greed just is really endemic within our politics today, and it's responsible for what we've seen in the past, and it's continuing on as we respond to this pandemic.
So Jenny, on the one hand, we have this group of people who think that maybe this pandemic is going to be the thing that tips the teeter-totter over and causes Americans to be more open to European-style social safety nets, and it may push them to demand that as the result of this crisis. On the other hand, a lot of people are suspicious of government and remain suspicious of government's ability to competently operate large societal programs or anything else for that matter. Won't this nation's miserable, shocking, shameful handling of this crisis play right into that impression? They can't do anything, so let's not do it.
It's a complicated narrative to unpack. we've been starving some of the public agencies that are in charge of running programs have had their budgets cut for a very long period of time. So the public health system is a great example. We've been cutting back at the federal, state, and local level on the number of people who work in public health, who work in county health departments. Those are exactly the kinds of places that need to set up testing sites and do outreach, provide support for school districts to tell them how to open safely and what they need to do. So we cut back on funding the agencies, then they're not able to do their jobs well. And then people say, well, look, the agencies are failing. Government can't do things well.
Do we do that because it's a political point of view that when you're in power with that point of view, that's what you do? Or is that a deliberate thing? Because Grover Norquist wants to, he's a Republican or a conservative operative, and wants to shrink government so that it will fit into a teacup. If you do that, it can't operate the way we expect it to.
So there definitely are some elected officials who are doing this intentionally, but there are also, some of this is again just a legacy of the Great Recession. So one of the things that we saw was that state and local revenues really got hard hit in the Great Recession. Property taxes went down because house prices dropped, state budgets were cut, and so they don't have the ability to just borrow indefinitely. State and local services especially got hit, and they never built back. So we have lower levels of employment at state and local government that provide a lot of these services on the ground because they were never really able to recover. I'm really worried about what's going to happen now. State and local revenues again are getting hit. Things like sales taxes are some of the first things to drop. That's going to make it harder for them to provide just basic services to their constituents.
Well, you bring up an interesting point, because not only are we losing tax revenues, we're spending an enormous amount of money from the government coffers, particularly the federal government's coffers, on supporting people during this crisis. And I'm wondering that when it's over, Michelle, will there be money to do things, even if employees get together and demand better protections, either from the government or from private enterprise or both? Will there be the money to do that?
We get what we demand. And, I think that the problem, particularly with unemployment insurance, after the last recession, as you point out, North Carolina emerged with a debt. And so there are two ways to deal with that debt. One is to just fund the fund by taxing employers. There is money there, or cutting benefits. And states like North Carolina chose that route to fill up the trust fund. We get what we ask for. And during periods of low unemployment, people tend to forget. They tend to not pay attention to the unemployment insurance system because nobody's using it and nobody really notices when it gets cut. So I think that now more than ever, we really have to keep our eye on the ball as we emerge from this recession to make sure that we don't, every state trust fund, I predict, will likely run out of money. And every state's going to react differently. And in order to make sure that your state is a state that doesn't do so by gutting benefits, you have to just organize.
Michelle Evermore is a senior policy analyst with the National Employment Law Project. She's here with Jen Schutz from the Brookings Institution and Dr. Victor Chen from Virginia Commonwealth University. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the social safety net and what happens next as this COVID-19 pandemic continues, seemingly unabated. Jen Schutz is with us from the Brookings Institution, Michelle Evermore from the National Employment Law Project, and Dr. Victor Chen with Virginia Commonwealth University and the author of Cut Loose, Jobless and Hopeless in an Unfair Economy. Bob, one of our listeners, emails, before the pandemic, our nation was negatively impacted by a child care crisis, underfunded education systems, economic struggles of working and middle class families, etc. We have a system set up to cause distress. The time is here to explore radical solutions to our shared distresses before we lose our shared existence, which Dr. Chen leads me to this question, because I was going to bring this up next. Joshua Clinton, who's a professor of political science at Vanderbilt University, believes that once this crisis is over, we will probably revert to our normal previous attitudes. He said that many Republicans living in states that had implemented programs like Obamacare and Medicaid still don't support them, even though they may be benefiting from them. So he sees a reversion. Do you agree with him, or do you agree with our emailer Bob over here?
Mm-hmm. I'm hopefully optimistic that, you know, things will change as a result of this crisis. I mean, these are the sorts of formative events that shape generations in terms of, you know, the kind of impact that this have on households. And you see things like the fact that we are seeing massive losses in health insurance during a pandemic. All these families, households are going, are losing the health insurance. Insurance, especially in red states that did not expand Medicaid, chose not to do that. And, you know, this is creating some public pressure to say, let's just have universal health care. Let's have a more robust state kind of intervention here to deal with this problem that we most clearly have. And so I think those sorts of things will change the calculus of voters, recognizing that suddenly things like universal health care don't seem so radical. Suddenly things like a universal basic income don't seem so radical given you know, what we've seen during the pandemic. So I think there is this potential to change things. And the younger generation, you know, as Jenny was mentioning before, really are being shaped by, you know, this this event. And hopefully that will shape their politics moving forward and their support for a safety net.
A lot of people who don't have insurance through the Affordable Care Act, Michelle, have it because they work and they get it from their employer. But if they're being laid off or furloughed, that ends after a certain amount of time because it's tied to your employment. Will we see employers change their attitude about this going forward and maybe advocate for universal health care? Will employees, will workers push for this? Will they have the leverage politically to push for this in any successful way?
Yeah, I think that there's a real chance. Historically, there have been moments in time where employers have pushed for something like Medicare for All because that's a cost and an administrative burden that they don't want to have to take on in some cases. And it's actually easier for them for it to be a federalized system. So it's not that unusual for employers to take that on. I would say, though, the other thing to keep in mind with health coverage is that there's a provision in HEROES to subsidize COBRA so that people can retain their health coverage. I think that that would be really enormously helpful if that made it into the next legislative package. Hmm.
One of the things that we've been arguing about for decades now, Doctor, it seems to me, is whether or not healthcare is a privilege or it's a right, and that was tried to be addressed a little bit by the Affordable Care Act, although that did not turn out to be the panacea that some hoped it would be, and there are still attempts to weaken that. But what this crisis is showing us is not only the problems with individual access to health care, but we have not adequately supported our health care systems. They are breaking down, and they cannot get the necessary gear to protect the doctors and nurses on the floors of these hospitals as they fight this pandemic, nor can they get the equipment. Should this crisis cause a reexamination of our attitude and our approach toward healthcare at large, not just insurance, but healthcare at large?
Yeah, I think so. I think that, just showing us how important it is to have a working federal government, an efficient system that's well-funded enough that has support at all levels. And without that, we run into problems. But more broadly, I think that, it's just a national travesty that we're seeing all these folks unemployed during a pandemic where they need testing, they need support, healthcare support for their conditions. And yet that is, it's really symbolic of this longstanding kind of problem we've dealt with. And it's really accentuating those problems, those gaps within our system. So I think, this is going to be a wake-up call, I think, for many, many policymakers and Americans about efficiencies.
Would it be true to say, Doctor, that the federal government has the money to do this right, and they have systems in place to do this right, that the systems aren't being used either because of incompetence or because of a deliberate political ideology or wishful thinking? Which is the truth? Do we not have the money to do this right? This is the United States of America. This is disgraceful, what's happening.
We are the richest country in the world, right? And we definitely have the money. We had the money to give tax cuts to millionaires and billionaires in 2017. We have the money to, you know, give all this, these tax breaks during the CARES Act. You know, we have all this money, you know, as Jenny mentioned before, to give to, you know, upper middle class homeowners through the mortgage interest, you know, tax deduction, right? We have this money. We're just not prioritizing it for all the talk of essential workers. We're not prioritizing it for the people that are working hard on the front lines to, you know, keep this economy afloat. We're not prioritizing it for, you know, households that really need it. And so once we get our priorities straight as a country, then I think we will find that we have more than enough wealth to go around and give people a decent standard of living.
Jenny, we've talked a little bit during this program about attitudes toward a social safety net in America as opposed to European countries where they seem to have more benefits and life seems to be a little easier when it comes to unemployment and health care and vacation time and things like that. And it's tied to our attitudes mostly about the poor, and I'm sure race creeps into this. Don't give them anything because they didn't work for it. Is there anything to indicate in societies where the social safety net is stronger that it makes people more reliant on government assistance and less productive?
Well, Europe is a great example that you can provide a strong social safety net without sacrificing productivity. European workers are at least as productive as Americans. They have more vacation time, but in part they use that to recharge so they don't burn out on their work. So, you know, the US does not actually have the most productive workers compared to other rich countries, in part because we don't provide the kind of safety net that people can use. So a great example is the childcare system. In the US, it's largely up to individual families and parents to pay for childcare for their kids, which means when their kids get sick or, you know, parents have to take time off work, they are less productive as workers. In Europe, childcare is much more subsidized and easy to come by, which allows parents to focus on work rather than trying to find a coverage for their sick kids, right? So part of what we need to understand is that these social safety net programs actually help people be more productive. The other thing I think that's really different between Europe and the US is that European countries, in part because of their shared history and in part because they're just physically closer together, have a more intuitive sense that the behavior of an individual affects their neighbors, affects their communities. You know, this is hopefully something that will change because of the pandemic. When you get sick, it's not just about you, it's about your family, it's about your neighbors, it's about your coworkers. Not providing adequate social safety net at the community level makes the entire community more vulnerable, both to public health problems and to economic dislocation. We have to understand that we're interconnected and that safety net for everybody makes the whole of society safer.
Michelle, in this first wave of help from the federal government, the Congress authorized spending $2 trillion. I can't even fathom how much money that is, but it's $2 trillion, and this is just the first wave. They're probably going to have to come up with more money, and it's coming from taxpayers. It's coming from us. I don't know whether we're going into debt for this. We probably are. Do we have any idea of how much it would cost to, once this is over, to extend our social safety net, to provide universal health care, to provide not necessarily a guaranteed income, but at least unemployment benefits that are livable and will pay your rent and your car payment in the interim while you look for a job? Is that affordable? Would there be money for us to do that on an ongoing basis in the United States?
Yeah, the money is definitely available. The marginal top tax rate is not anywhere near as high as it's been historically. And I'd also like to point out how some of these things do pay for themselves. For example, the employer-sponsored healthcare system is extremely inefficient. There are efficiencies that could be found in a single-payer type system. Providing a good unemployment insurance benefit means that workers, when they're out of work, have enough money to continue to purchase things in the local economy and the comfort that they need to be able to find a job that suits their skills. And that's good for workers and employers. So some of these things really do pay for themselves as long as we're just not trying to figure out the shortest, quickest, fastest way to save money.
Taxes are much lower today, Dr. Chen, than they were, say, in the 1950s. And they keep being, people call for more tax cuts, which as one county manager told me repeatedly here on this program, taxes equal services. You cut taxes, you have less services. By how much would we have to raise taxes to achieve some of the things that people are advocating for?
Well, we will have to raise taxes, but you should think of this kind of investment in the social safety net as an investment, right? That we are providing conditions that allow people to be productive in their lives, to lead meaningful lives, to lead productive lives as workers in order to get into the workforce. You know, people need childcare. In order to, stay working, they need health care. They need health insurance, right? They need that surety and that stability in their work. Lives in order to make the most of their careers, right? And we see that going to college, investing that money, taking on debt even to go to college is vitally important for an individual's future trajectory. The same thing goes for a society, and especially given the collective problems, not the individual problems, the collective problems we're facing in terms of global competition, in terms of automation, and so on. We need to be investing in our people moving forward.
And if I'm not mistaken, one of the things you talk about in one of your books is that what we're looking at now with the lower economic classes is what you can anticipate, what white-collar workers can anticipate going forward because of some of the forces you just talked about, automation and more, correct?
Yeah, the robots are coming for all of us, in terms of the types of work that can be automated away as artificial intelligence becomes more advanced, as certain processes become automated. So that is going to affect a broad segment of the population much more than factory workers, as it has been, so far. And that's going to change the political calculus, Mike. It's going to make people understand, hey, we got to do something about this. We need to provide some sort of living wage for everyone who doesn't have work because there's just not enough work out there. And this pandemic is a wake-up call, an early wake-up call, I believe, to the situation we may have moving forward.
So, Jen, there's also a housing aspect of this crisis that we really haven't addressed here. Evictions have been temporarily suspended. I'm sure that ends soon in most parts of the country. And because we have an affordable housing crisis here in Charlotte, that we have learned that housing instability is a key factor to economic instability. It's a major contributing factor to that for individuals and by extension to society at large. What needs to be done to help people stay in their homes, whether they pay rent or pay a mortgage?
The most important and effective thing that Congress could do right now is to send people another round of checks. So it's much easier to just send people checks so that they can continue to pay the rent or the mortgage than to try to put in place sort of a legal framework to protect people, which then requires enforcement by the local government. Congress doesn't have a lot of levers to protect particularly renters from eviction. Most people rent from private landlords. Relations between landlords and tenants are regulated by state governments and enforced by local governments. But Congress can just send people checks so they can keep paying the rent, and that's the best thing they could possibly do.
And that, it seems to me, would have a great political import for both banks. Banks would want this because they don't want people to default. Mortgage companies, landlords would want this because they want to get the revenue, and they have mortgages to pay too. So it seemed to me there would be a lot of political support for this. We only have a couple of seconds left, but I want to hear from all three of you about what, if we were open to improving how the social safety net works right now, what would be your top recommendation? Michelle, I'll start with you. One thing that you would start with.
Federalize unemployment insurance.
You would do what with unemployment insurance?
I would federalize it.
Federalize it. Victor. Mm-hmm.
I would say that we should extend the $600 benefit and make it not contingent on work. So that would remove some of this incentive effects and move us forward to universal basic income, which is, I think, what we really need.
Jen.
I think we should tie a lot of these benefits and safety net to measures of how the economy is doing. So a mechanism called automatic stabilizers, when the unemployment rate goes above some amount, We start sending out checks to individuals. We provide more unemployment insurance benefits. Congress doesn't have to make a decision on a case-by-case basis.
Jen Schutz is a fellow with the Metropolitan Policy Program and the Future of the Middle Class Initiative at the Brookings Institution. Michelle Evermore is a senior policy analyst at the National Employment Law Project. And Dr. Victor Chen is an associate professor of sociology and social policy at Virginia Commonwealth and author of Cut Loose, Jobless and Hopeless in an Unfair Economy. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.